calculations are correct, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious shit.
Back for another week of Tuesday Timelines, episode 15. No, 16.
Yes, 16.
Episode 16. I'm Elio. He's Ben. Ben, what's going on?
This is not a good omen, folks. I'm already having to correct him this early on in the episode. Oh my god.
Listen. I had a dentist appointment earlier this afternoon, okay? I had my own match with the dentist. She was pretty... Well, we'll save that for off the air. Never mind. Wow. But you get it.
Yes, I understand. I don't like the dentist either. But,
Oh, I loved mine. She was pretty cool.
Well, I like the people that I use, but the process...
Oh, I know. No, I know. It's like...
unpleasant.
And what I hate is, like, you're there and they're like, open, or they're like, okay, relax your muscles, you're too tense. I'm like, I'm trying to open, I'm trying to relax, what do you want me to do?
Exactly.
You know, it's like open, and then I love when they do this, like, where I go like this, they're like, you got some bleeding. No, this was when I was younger, but they're like, you got some bleeding. Well, gee, I wonder why. Maybe could it be that you're poking around with sharp instruments?
Yeah.
Like in the one hygienist, I like when they go, how many times do you brush? None. I stopped brushing years ago. Why do I need to smile? What is a smile? All you're doing is showing someone else your teeth. You know what their answer would be? Big deal, you're not special, I've got teeth too.
Exactly. Well, that's a good comeback.
But when I do that, I scared the last one. I was at my last appointment, I scared him when I said that I don't brush anymore. She had this like terrified look on her face.
Well, I would too if I had to stick my fingers in someone's mouth. So that in and of itself is awfully disgusting. But you know what was almost as equally terrifying?
What's that?
This SummerSlam 1990 card that I had to watch last night.
Oh, you didn't like the card?
No.
I'm sure you have questions for me.
Yes, I do.
And I have answers for you, along with videos.
Yes, well, thank God for the videos, especially this time, because, you know, one of the things that I'm
thank
starting
you. Keep,
to...
Keep going. I'm just going to connect my speakers here.
Yes. One of the things that I'm really starting to notice about these early pay-per-views, and I thought maybe it was exclusive to WrestleMania, but it's really not, is they have a really large amount of short matches on these shows to fill out the card leading up to, like, the two major matches. And it's a very annoying pattern that I'm noticing, because it's like, why are they doing this? And then the other thing that I know is not exclusive to you know, one pay-per-view or the other, you know, in these early days, is the mid-show intermission. Okay, now it would be different if we're talking about, you know, if you're attending like an indie show or something like that, because Elite has like 2.5 hour shows, that has an intermission.
And
And that
I'm sure their shows are more entertaining than Raw and SmackDown some weeks.
well and I'm not just saying this because I'm associated with them, I'm telling you the truth. Honestly, I find Elite more entertaining than WWE on a lot of different occasions.
Two hours is more than enough for a
Now,
show.
obvi yes, I agree. Now, obviously, I'm not saying WWE can be touched in terms of production and some of the things that they do. Like, an independent promotion is not capable of putting on a show the caliber of a WrestleMania or a SummerSlam. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying what they do on the indies in terms of, I'm talking like a quality promotion like Elite, who does things the right way. If you pace your show properly, you can get a really solid show out of 2 hours, right?
Yep.
And that and or two, 2.5, which is what they do. And that's with an intermission. But I noticed because this SummerSlam 90, which is the main focus of tonight, was 2 hours and 40 minutes. So not that far off from what Elite typically is when they do their major shows throughout the year. They had the longest intermission I think I've ever witnessed on the show.
Hold
And
on, hold
to
on. Did they have that SummerSlam intermission card up on the screen?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, okay. I
Well,
remember they used to do that for WrestleMania a lot.
and in but in addition to that, they had so many video packages. It was rough. So not only from a match perspective was it rough at certain points, but just from like the amount of wasted airtime. And even if they weren't doing a video package, there was a lot of wasted airtime that could have been focused on giving a match an extra 3 or 4 minutes that even
Especially one match that we'll get into during this show.
yes, and I think I know exactly which match you're gonna talk about. So it'll be interesting to see if we're thinking of the same one. But enough of my rambling. Why don't we get started with SummerSlam
Well,
1990?
before that, do you know where we have to go?
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
All right, this movie is one of my favorites. I remember when this movie came out, they had the regular black VHS tape, then they had the special white VHS tape. So this one is Ghost.
What's the matter? Seems like whenever anything good in my life happens, I'm just afraid I'm gonna lose it.
I really love you.
What do you want? What's happening?
It's like I think about you every minute. It's like I can still feel you.
The problem with you is you still think you're real. It's all up here now. You want to move something, you gotta move it with your mind.
Molly, why can't you hear me?
Who is that?
You can hear me?
Can you hear me? Sam Weeks. Say my name. Say it.
Leave me
Say my
alone.
name.
Who
Say it.
the
Say it.
hell?
Say it.
Hello? I got a message from Sam.
What? Sam Weed? He asked me to call. Once you go to police, he said it was a setup. He was murdered.
She said Sam knew who killed him.
Are you out of your mind? I mean, what are you going to tell the police?
She knew things, private things.
I know about the green underwear that you wrote your name on.
Well, this psychic woman's got a record that goes back a long way.
Don't you see? I'm not a fake.
I don't know what's real anymore.
Don't open him. Don't open the damn door. He's a murderer.
Why are you doing this to me? You hear me? Why are you doing this to me? Sam's dead.
Tell her I love her.
He says he loves you. Sam would never say that.
You gotta take all your anger, all your love, all your hate, and then let it explode. Molly?
Molly, you in danger, girl.
That is like one of my favorite movies.
You know, I've seen it. It strikes me as too much of a romance movie for my.
That part is I'm the same with that part, but I just love the whole ghost part and like the ghost in the subway scene. Those are that's the part of this movie that I really enjoy. It's like that's like the murder and they're trying to solve like who. They're trying to like clear the names and like who actually committed the murder.
Yes, it's in that way. It's very similar to the game that we play at the end of the main show sometimes.
Yes, the murder mystery, which I gotta find. I think I have some still here.
Yes, exactly.
But Ben, now it is time to get into WWF SummerSlam 1990. And we are in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Spectrum local time is 8 p.m. Ben, SummerSlam 1990. What do we have to begin with? First, we have a dark match, actually. It was Shane Douglas defeating Buddy Rose. There was only one match.
Well, I wasn't even aware of that. But,
yeah, well, they didn't put dark matches on it this time. There was no kickoff shows or pre-shows or whatever.
Oh, the good old days. They should do that again. They really should. Because I guarantee you, even with it now being, you know, a two-night WrestleMania, you know, spectacular, we're still going to get stuff that doesn't have to be on the show because everybody has to be on the show. You know, and I don't agree with that. You know, WrestleMania and also the other big three shows, SummerSlam included, they need to be treated like, you know, Triple H treated the NXT takeovers of old. You know, five matches, the big stories are the ones. Now, I'm not saying WrestleMania should be five matches, but
that,
you know,
that's what they do with New Japan. Because I got my hands on the brackets for the New Japan Cup, and all the names in the tournament, they put them all in tag team matches, like on a show. That's why we have so many tag team matches, one after another for another. Like, we
Stop.
Don't need that.
Don't do that.
If it's a tournament, it has to be a tournament. That's it.
So and automatically, right off the bat, I wouldn't have even had this match because Shawn Michaels had an injury coming into it, and you know it was just it made sense story wise because of what they were trying to do with Power and Glory, But even so, I would have just canceled the match and had one last match on this card.
So this is match number one, The Rock versus Power and Glory. Do you know the story here?
So yes, the story was that Shawn Michaels legitimately had a knee injury coming in. So they knew he wasn't going to be doing anything. So that's why they had that. That's why they called the audible into the handicap match. It became with Marty Jannetty versus Hercules and Paul Roma.
No, I'm talking about the background story, how this match came about.
I thought you were just talking about how it became.
No. This about how this match came out, because it may look like a random match, right?
Well, yeah, but I'm sure.
However, on an episode of WWF Wrestling Challenge, Paul Roma had just had a match. I can't remember against who, but it had to have been one of Jimmy Hart's teams. I want to say it was Rhythm and Blues or some team, one of the teams, but because the commentators said that he was struck with like an object in the head. So I'm guessing it had to have been Jimmy Hart, one of Jimmy Hart's teams. Anyways, Paul Roma is still in the ring. Referee's trying to help him because he's knocked out. The Rockers make their way out for their match up next. And right. This is where we get the story of how this match came to be.
Megaphone in the back of the head. Rockers coming over to help him out a little bit. Ring announcer a little premature introducing the Rockers.
Well, they knocked Roma out.
Whoa. What's Roma doing? Little animosity maybe between Roma and the Rockers. I don't know. Look at this. What is going on?
Maybe Roma figures it was the Rockers that sucked her in.
No, not hardly.
How do you know? He's been knocked out.
I don't know if he was knocked out or not. Whoa! What is this? What's going down here, Jesse?
I don't know, but the mighty Hercules coming into Roma's defense here.
First of all, I think the Rockers are at fault here. What business is it theirs of what happened to Paul Roma? They're coming to No!
Paul Roma's heel turn. And that's how this match came about.
Very cool. I love those videos because it fills in so many blanks.
All right, so what else do you have for this one, or is that it?
So when they made it into a handicap match because they covered up the injury angle by having Hercules attack Michael's knee with the chain, which I thought was very well done. So Jannetty had a very good showing going it alone for his team. Jannetty could have done so much more had his issues not taken over, because he was so talented. But I particularly like the attack post-match, because the way that they did it was, it wasn't just like an out and out, okay, Shawn Michaels is out of the match because he got attacked and now it's a 2-on-1 situation. Shawn Michaels was at ringside, quote unquote, trying to, you know, collect himself, you know, the entire time. But he could never get up on the apron in Jannetty's corner. So that's why, in effect, this was a 2-on-1 situation. And then after the bell, I think it was Hercules who brought Shawn Michaels into the ring and continued to do damage to his leg. And then Jannetty was like laying on Shawn Michaels' leg trying to protect it. And so the way that whole thing was executed was great. Now, I'm not sure how long Michaels was out because of this injury, but its execution was done fantastically. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I've never seen an injury angle handled quite like that before. So that, in a way, that was refreshing. And I like the fact that it wasn't just a straight up squash match afterwards either, because Jannetty still had a very good showing for himself, which, quite frankly, against a powerhouse such as Hercules. Now, let's not sell Paul Roma short, because he was a tag team specialist. Let's not forget about him either. You know, that was a very good showing for Marty Jannetty. So was it the greatest thing? No, but they made something out of a situation where they could have gone home in 30 seconds and nobody, including myself, would have blinked. But instead, they made it something out of it, and they made it interesting. So that was a good way to start the show, given what they had. And you know, because if I was looking at this from just a list of matches, I'm like, oh, well, automatically that would have been a low point, you know, because was I the biggest fan of Power and Glory? No. because of everything that I've seen from them.
I can't believe they put these two guys together. I mean, they couldn't be any more different.
Well, exactly, because it goes back to what I was saying with Paul Roma being a tag team specialist, because remember, he was in the Young Stallions with Jim Powers. So it's not like Paul Roma was a non-entity as a tag team competitor, but at least with Powers, it made sense. They played off of each other, you know. But you know, with Hercules, pardon me stating the obvious, but it was like opposites to the max. And you're like, no shit, man. It goddamn, we have eyeballs. Well, I know, but it, you know, they really made this into something interesting, which I wish they had done with some of the other matches throughout the evening. But for a kickoff match and having to deal with a curveball and Shawn Michaels' injury, this was pretty decent.
All right, so on to match number two, the Intercontinental Championship. Now, Ben, do you know the story behind this match and how this match came about?
No. That was very random, and that was actually going to be my first question. No. And beat me to it.
I have another video to play for you. This is going back to WrestleMania 6 for a moment.
Okay, very good.
From the World Wrestling Federation magazine, this is Special Report.
Hello, everyone. I'm Lord Alfred Hayes. Following WrestleMania 6, the Ultimate Warrior now holds two titles, the World Wrestling Federation title and the Intercontinental title. In face of this unprecedented situation, the World Wrestling Federation president, Jack Tunney, had this statement to make.
As of April 1st of this year, World Wrestling Federation history was made. with one man holding both the Intercontinental Championship and the World Wrestling Federation title. Since it is obvious that no one man can properly fulfill the requirements of both title defenses at the same time, the Ultimate Warrior has surrendered to me, as of this date, the Intercontinental Championship. I have declared the title vacant and furthermore have ordered that a tournament be held to determine who will become the new Intercontinental Champion. The pairings and participants in the tournament will be announced next week. Thank you.
After this official statement, a tournament for the vacant Intercontinental title will shortly be forthcoming. Next week, the official pairings will be announced. For the World Wrestling Federation, this has been Special Report.
And I have the brackets for that tournament in front of me.
Okay, go ahead.
I think we have time before we go into commercial because I don't want to get into the match until we come back.
Okay, very good.
So, the Intercontinental Championship tournament from 1990. Now, the quarterfinals were as follows. Tito Santana versus Akeem. Brutus Beefcake versus Dino Bravo. Mr. Perfect versus Jimmy Snuka. And Roddy Piper versus Rick Martel. So the first match, Tito Santana, I believe, received a bye. It says he received a bye because give me a second. We'll be right back. All right, Ben. So Tito Santana received a bye into this. Received a bye into the semifinals against Akeem because he won by countout.
I hate it when they do that, especially in a fucking tournament.
And then the next match, Brutus Beefcake versus Dino Bravo. Pick a winner, Ben.
Dino Bravo. That was a nice pick. No,
double countout.
What the fuck?
So in that case, that's why there was a bye, because Tito Santana won by countout, but the second match was a double countout. In the third quarterfinal, it was Mr. Perfect defeating Jimmy Snuka, and Roddy Piper versus Rick Martel ended in a double disqualification.
I have to admit, this is the first time that I'm hearing the backstory of the whole, you know, Intercontinental tournament thing and why.
This was a very weird tournament, actually.
Yes, it's a very weird lineup now that I'm hearing it. But this is the first time I'm hearing about the tournament and why it was laid down. And during the commercial, I kind of commented to Elio that, while I understand the reasoning, it kind of lessens the impact of Hogan versus Warrior at WrestleMania 6, because that was such a, iconic moment. And if you missed our full review on last week's episode of Tuesday Timeline, I do highly encourage you to go check that out. That's one of my favorite episodes we've done recently across both the main show and this one. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. I get it, but at the same time, this is WWE. This isn't UFC kind of thing. Like, I get why they vacate titles in the UFC when it's one guy holding two titles, but you can kind of navigate around that, at least in my opinion, when you're dealing with, professional wrestling. So I don't know if I quite agree with that, but given the way it turned out, and we're going to go over this match when we get back from the break, I kind of like how it created a moment for an up-and-coming wrestler. And we'll talk more about that when we get back from the break.
Hold on, let me finish this tournament, because She was Santana, and Mr. Perfect received a bye all the way to the final. So that is how Mr. Perfect became the Intercontinental Champion.
Okay.
He defeated Tito Santana in the finals.
Well, it's kind of weak already if two competitors receive byes to the finals.
Yeah, this tournament was weird. You know what? This tournament was held on TV. It wasn't even held like... It was just held on the regular Saturday programs where we usually see the enhancement talents.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of double screws it right from the get-go. So we will
get into this match after we come back from our break. Stay tuned. And we are back, and we are going to get into match number two of SummerSlam 90, the Intercontinental Championship, the champion Mr. Perfect, defending against newcomer Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. Ben, what do you have here after I give you the backstory on this match and how it came about?
So, yeah, well, first of all, I'm very glad you gave me the backstory because by itself, it seems kind of random. By the way, the commentary made it seem as if it was kind of random because the story that they gave going in was that Mr. Perfect accepted Texas Tornado's challenge on 10 days notice, which as a defending champion doesn't seem to be a very sound strategy. So that's what the commentary was playing with during the lead up to the match with the pre-show and post-show, with the pre-match and post-match comments. And also I noticed, especially during the post-match stuff with Gene Okerlund, that he was being referred to as Kerry Von Erich quite a bit, even though WWE had made no mention that he was Kerry Von Erich and just kind of billing him as the Texas Tornado, which I understand that WWE likes to have their own names, and we've seen that plenty of times. With you know, family members of iconic names in the industry, including Mr. Perfect's own son going under a very weird name in Michael McGillicuddy.
That was a stupid name. Why do you do that to the son of a legend?
An absolute legend. And you know, the word legend gets thrown around a lot, but let's not insult Mr. Perfect. I mean, he is the epitome of that term, without question in my book. And that's what makes what he kind of was willing to do in this match even more impressive. And they were kind of I think the commentary was kind of underselling the Texas Tornado in this match, even though they did make reference to the fact that he was a veteran coming in. They didn't get into just how big of a veteran he was, because you have to understand, folks, and yes, I knew this before the Von Erich special came out, because I haven't seen it yet, you fucking goons. So I don't want to hear any of that. Oh, you don't know.
You fucking goons.
So I don't want to hear that. I don't know anything about the Von Erichs going in.
You don't know anything about the Von Erichs. Sorry.
Well, I'm gonna pull a line on you that you pulled on me last week. I hate people, so fuck you, Elio, and fuck me, and fuck all these people, whatever the fuck. No.
Wait. It's a bet. It's like this. You know what? Fuck you. Fuck me. Fuck everyone.
Exactly. I love it. But no, I've done plenty of research on the Von Erichs in the past for this very show. I don't want to hear it. Yet. Pieces of shit. Internet wrestling community nerds.
Ben, I'm 50 years old. I thought I was the cranky old man on this show. What the hell?
No, because I can just hear it now. You know, if we were active on social media with the show, that's exactly what we would be hearing from people that don't listen to this show regularly, which is why we still appreciate our dedicated audience who does. I mean, if you are a member of that audience, we appreciate you very much. What I'm referring to is that they didn't make mention of the fact that Carrie Von Erich was very well established in World Class Championship Wrestling for 11 years prior to coming into WWE, and a four-time world champion prior to joining WWE.
Yeah, you know why?
Because they wanted to build him as their own star and not coming in as an established star.
Because the person that was running WWF back then doesn't like any wrestler that he didn't create.
Well, exactly. But at the same time, it's like, you know, this is the Von Erichs, for fuck's sake. Everybody knew it was, you know, that Texas Tornado was a Von Erich. Even Gene Okerlund would call them the Texas Tornado, Carrie Von Erich.
Mm-hmm.
In the post show, or I'm sorry, I keep saying post show, post match comments. But but I like the story that they told in this match, and that was, you know, the veteran and Mr. Perfect kind of overlooking the new guy in the Texas Tornado and getting surprised in 5 minutes and losing his Intercontinental title as a result, because, you know, Jerry Von Erich was hitting several moves from the jump that was surprising Mr. Perfect and kept rolling to the outside to have conferences with Bobby Heenan. And let me just say, Bobby Heenan is tremendous. You know, if you call yourself a wrestling fan and you are not familiar with Bobby Heenan, I don't know what the fuck you're doing with your life, regardless of what generation you came from. You need to understand how fantastic Bobby Heenan is. So if you're not
familiar, I'm not going to tell you a story off air, Ben. You're going to be like, what the fuck?
Kind of like what I was with my rant just a few minutes ago. Yeah. I'm sure I will be. But Mr. Perfect was taking for granted the fact that he was just going to roll past the Texas Tornado. And, once he kind of absorbed the initial offensive barrage of Mr. Perfect, he kind of got pissed off after being slapped around talking about Carrie Von Erich, and he did his own version of hulking up, and he kind of stood there, and Mr. Perfect turned around, and Carrie had this pissed off look on his face. It was like, in no uncertain terms, okay, I'm gonna fuck you up Texas style now, and we're gonna have a physical conversation. And from that point forward, he kind of took over the match, and the long story short, he captured the title after hitting Mr. Perfect with a discus punch. I'm not sure if I've ever seen a discus punch used as a finisher. The closest thing I can compare it to is like a Judas effect, but that's like more of arm usage than anything else. But yeah, I As a match, you can't really say much about it because it was, you know, 5 minutes long. But having said that, Mr. Perfect sold his ass off, and I think they accomplished what they wanted to by establishing Kerry Von Erich as a star right off the bat. And unfortunately, if you know the story and some of the backgrounds regarding the Von Erichs, they have a very tragic background. And like I said, I haven't even seen the Iron Claw, so I'm not even sure if I know the full extent of it. But
MJF plays Lance Von Erich.
Yes, I understand he has a small role, and he actually met John Cena at the premiere of Iron Claw. So
I saw the movie. I'm like, wait a minute, how did I miss MJF though?
But what's so interesting about that story is it's so tragic that the wrestling almost becomes like second nature. There's something referred to as the Von Erich curse, and if you really understand the story, I mean, Fritz Von Erich, the patriarch of that family, he buried 5 of his 6 sons. So, I mean, that tells you how tragic that story ended up being. And thank God Kevin survived. Can you imagine having to bury all 6 of them? Jesus Christ. But yeah, this was a good way to get Kerry established. And unfortunately, this would be the only title he would win in WWF at the time, because he left the world under very tragic circumstances 3 years later. But at least the WWF did get a glance at Kerry Von Erich in very iconic fashion upon his debut. So I for historic perspective and just appreciation, I would give this a high point for both Kerry Von Erich and Mr. Paul, because both of them had very tragic ends, and they were so incredibly talented.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this match. Now, quick story. I was a huge fan of like the WF themes. Like, for some reason, my friend decided he was gonna pay the money and join the WWF fan club. So they send him like all these things and what like that, cause little cassette with the themes. Now at this time, right, I really enjoy the themes. I was trying to make one of like little mix metal remixes, like with themes like Undertaker, etc., and Bret Hart, the Hart Foundation. I combined with the audio clips.
Right.
So I wanted the Texas Tornadoes theme because I thought it was really cool. So I would put my radio next to the television speaker and record it from SummerSlam. It didn't turn out very good, but I'm like, I want that theme. So that was as close as I came to getting that theme before they actually released it.
That's awesome. That's just awesome. You know, those kind of stories tell you that Elio is a super fan in the coolest kind of way, not the nerdy IWC let's bitch about everything kind of.
And then 1991. When we get into 91, I'm going to tell you another story about what I did at school once.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm looking forward to that story. Talk about a cliffhanger.
It was a day off, so I took the day off and play what I did, which I wasn't supposed to do, because you're not supposed to be off school. It doesn't matter if there's no class. You have to be in school. But I'll tell you what I did when we get there.
All right, very cool. And then, knowing what happened shortly after this with Sapphire, this next segment slash theme of the show.
See, this is where they could have added another match or given another match more time. We didn't have to spend all that dead air waiting for Sapphire to come out.
Well, and not only that, but also the interview segment with Dusty Rhodes where he cut it off and said, "I gotta go look for Sapphire.
I gotta take care of business."
Exactly, and that impression was fantastic. I appreciate that. So it was scheduled to be Sensational Cherry versus Sapphire in a singles match. Remember,
I really don't understand. I'm looking for my sweet Sapphire. I can't find her anywhere. I don't know. I gotta go look for her.
Holy shit! Would you? Elio, okay, that's it. You're taking this segment because if you keep doing that, I'm just gonna die laughing, and I can't. You're in charge of this segment. I can't follow that.
Yeah. So this match, I don't know. Like, I wasn't looking forward to it. Number one, number two. Sensational Sherry deserves better than this. I mean, getting put in the ring with Sapphire, someone who's not even a wrestler.
Exactly.
And you're okay, so you introduced Sherry. I think Sherry was already in the ring, or no, she came out to the ring.
Yes.
Or was she already in there and they were just playing the music?
No, she came out because she,
okay, so she came out to
the
ring.
She had a backstage thing with Okerlund beforehand.
Alright, so she came out to the ring. And then Howard Finkel's there. He's like, okay, now we're going to introduce Sweet Sapphire. So the camera pans over to the entrance. And here's where you're killing time. You're like, it's just dead air. Where, why are we waiting for this? We know she's not going to come out for some reason, which will be explained later on in the show. And I'll tell you about that one, the background of that one. Because I have to look for the video, but this match, for me, it wasn't a match. It was just a waste of time.
No. So, because pretty much Sapphire was given 30 seconds to appear, to get to the ring, and she was counted out, and so Sensational Sherry was awarded the quote-unquote match by forfeit. And then a little bit later in the evening is when the interview was conducted with Dusty Rhodes, where he said that he had to go look for Sapphire. And while I'm looking forward to the story that Elio tells, because I haven't heard it, I do know that Sapphire was released from WWE. F shortly after this.
I have to look up the video, and so you want to take the next match, which is a random one.
Yes, and let me tell you something, folks. When Elio says this match is random, let me double down on that for you and enthusiastically agree. All right, because this is another one of those 5.5 minute matches that when these kind of things happen, I can't stand them because, you know, as opponents, Tito Santana and the Warlord, now Elio, as the professor of this podcast, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I know, Tito Santana and the Warlord have nothing to do with each other.
Nope.
So pretty much this match was done to put the Warlord over as a heel. Here's the problem with that, folks. The Warlord just wasn't that good. And was it just me, or did he look like Stone Cold Steve Austin in steroids?
Right, <geez. laughs> what the hell? I'm like, you know what I want to see now? I want to see the Warlord from 1990 versus Stone Cold Steve Austin. Someone has to make that match.
Because, I mean, he was like the Super Shredder version of Stone Cold Steve Austin, except Stone Cold Steve Austin could actually fucking wrestle. The Warlord could not.
I think it was Roddy Piper that called him defending the opera, which, no, stop it. Just clear that stupid mask. That was nowhere near the Phantom of the Opera.
Well, no, it wasn't, but...
And by the way, I love Roddy Piper as a wrestler on commentary. I don't like him as a commentator.
Well, it was very awkward, and I looked that up as well, because it was like... I think I even messaged you and was like, what is Roddy Piper doing on commentary? But I looked it up, after I finished the show, and it was originally supposed to be Jesse the Body Ventura and Vince on commentary, according to my research. And I don't know why. I don't know the story here, but apparently... the Body had left WWF shortly before this show. Maybe a couple months beforehand, but not very long. The most entertaining aspect of this match was hearing Vince say "Arriba," or maybe the fact that we didn't have to hear Jesse the Body Ventura refer to Tito Santana as Chico, but that's about the high point of this match, because what the fuck? And this is a question that I have for you in all seriousness, because to me this was just the most random thing I've ever seen, arguably. Why, or I'm sorry, let me phrase this properly. You ready for this?
Yes, sir.
What the fuck is Slick doing with the Warlord?
Yeah, apparently the Warlord was another one of the guys he managed. He had the Twin Towers. He had Bolsheviks. He had the Warlord. He had Rick Martel.
I mean, good, but the Warlord, why?
I really don't understand that pairing. That was really weird and random.
I just, but...
You know what? I'm going to look that up real quick, because that's going to bother me. Go ahead.
But again, there's really nothing more to say, because this is just one of those matches that didn't have to be a thing on this show. This just didn't make any sense. And this is why
Okay, Ben, here we go.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in March of 1990, the Powers of Pain split with Fuji.
Right, I remember
the Powers
that.
The Powers of Pain split with Fuji selling Barbarian's contract to Bobby the Brain Heenan, while selling the Warlord's contract to Slick.
Okay.
So that really doesn't explain much, but that's how... Slick and Warlord got paired up. Is Mr. Fuji sold Warlord's contract to Slick?
I still say that's a random fucking pairing, though.
Yep.
Good Lord. Next up, see, this is why I'm so glad I have the professor on this show. If I'm being honest with you, Elio, I think either one of us could do the other show solo if we had to, under emergency circumstances. Mm-hmm. Not that we would want to, but I think we could if we had to for some reason, right? But I can comfortably tell you that I wouldn't even want to attempt to do this show with this format without you, because if I didn't have you to answer these questions, I'd be like, what in the is going on? I mean, I would probably sound like the biggest dumb fuck in the history of wrestling podcast.
This is why I love this show, because you have questions for me, and I have videos to answer them with.
Okay, so we finally get to a high point, because at this point in the show, I'm struggling.
I'm gonna set up the video, because I have one for this match.
Because I almost texted you. I'm like, Elio, if this show doesn't pick up qu quickly, I can't do this. Because, I was not doing well last night. I wasn't feeling well. This wasn't starting out very well, and I was getting very impatient, and this was going to be a 3.5 hour show pretty much, and I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. But then the wrestling gods dropped me a golden nugget, and we got Demolition and the Hart Foundation in a 2 out of 3 falls match. Now, in all fairness, if I'm being honest, the second fall was executed like shit. I just have to tell you, because the way that it was broken up was, I believe it was Crush. Instead of breaking up the pin, he dives over a Bret Hart and just tackles the referee, and then I forget which Hebner it was. They're twins. I'm sorry. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes.
It's always Dave until 96, 97. Remember that. It's always Dave until 96, 97. Because then he went on to become a road agent. And Earl took over.
Pretty much prior to this, the only time we saw Earl as a ref was when they did the angle with Hogan, right? That clarifies it for me tremendously. See, another example why we have Elio on the show. But so that looks stupid because he literally tackles Dave Hebner and then carries him around the ring like a sack of potatoes for a few seconds. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? But the rest of this match was, in my opinion, the high point of high points of this show. And I would recommend that if you are a fan of the Hart Foundation or Demolition, that you go out of your way to go on Peacock and watch this match, because this was an absolute thing of beauty outside of the awkward execution of that second fall.
Now, Ben, what do you? Oh, go on. Go on. Go
And
ahead.
I, honestly, folks, when a match is this good, it's hard for me to analyze it because I forget to analyze it, and I just enjoy it as a fan. The majority of matches, I'm constant when I have to review a show for this podcast or when I was on Wrestling POV, I'm constantly pausing and rewinding, and I'm analyzing different parts, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna talk about this sequence, I'm gonna talk about this part. This part's a high point. Oh, I don't like that match. That point's the low point. Oh, this sucks. Why is Cody Rhodes doing this? Acting like a bitch. That kind of thing, right? But with these kind of matches, I put down the notepad or take off the virtual headset, and I just become a fan and get lost. And that's what happened with this match. And it was a 2 to 1 victory oh God,
Our foundation.
yes. I don't know why I struggle with that. I knew who won the match. I just couldn't get it out. But the one thing that irritated me, and I do understand this because I understand why Crush came into the whole demolition thing. But I didn't. If there's one thing outside of the weird execution of the second fall that I didn't like. It was the interference of Axe and all the stuff with LOD at the end of the match.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point in time, Demolition was a trio with the originals, Axe and Smash,
yep.
and then Crush, Bryan Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would operate under the Freebird rule while Demolition had the tag team titles, which means, and if you're not familiar with that, with the Freebird rule, it means that any member of that tag team can participate in a standard tag team match to defend the tag team titles while the team holds them. So that's why Crush was in there with Smash at the time.
Right. All right, Ben, I've got a couple of videos for you. I mean, we done?
Yes.
All right, let me see if I can actually pull some. I'm gonna play this one, then I'm gonna play the other one that I found after we come back from break.
Okay.
So here we go.
Should be one of the more interesting Brother Love shows. From these two on, you never can tell what's going to happen. They're all interesting, McMahon. Not really. Hello, that's interesting.
You know, it looks to me like the Demolition, that they're afraid, that their mascara's starting to run a little bit, and that they're afraid of the Hart Foundation, and that if this thing was 2-on-2, that they would lose those belts.
Well, you see, that's where you're all wrong, because Demolition is afraid of no man. They're not afraid of you, and they're certainly not afraid of you.
Well, listen, Brother Love, I don't care if it's 1-on-1, 2-on-2, or 3-on-2. They hit their lies. We're going to clean up this mess. We're going to take those belts back. And if the Demolition were here right now, we'd tell them right to their face.
Let's go to ringside, let's put the belts up, and let's go.
settle it right now. And that's exactly what Demolition's doing, settling it right now.
Alright, we're back in bed. Before I break, I played a video clip for you of Demolition confronting the Heart Foundation on Brother Love Show, which ended in a brawl.
Yep.
Alright, I found the follow-up. This is another episode of the Brother Love Show. This ties in with SummerSlam.
Very cool.
The lead up to SummerSlam 1990.
So, clearly it became a thing for the heels to kiss Brother Love's ass, because later on in the show, you're going to get another example of that, because I was forced to suffer through another edition of the Brother Love show.
I remember this one.
Now, granted, folks, some of you may have enjoyed Brother Love. The character. But I find Bruce Pritchard, the man behind the character, to be so positively nauseating. It's just difficult. And, seeing an American citizen, the quality of a Sergeant Slaughter. Now, granted, this was all in storyline, but seeing Sergeant Slaughter kiss Bruce Pritchard, aka Brother Love's ass, it's just a little, too much for me. But we'll get to that segment when it comes up. I think it's after this next match. And I'm sure you'll find this next match riveting, Elio, just as riveting as I did. Actually, spoiler alert, it wasn't that riveting. But don't tune out of the podcast just yet, because despite the matchup being that riveting, I'm going to make my commentary very riveting. Because
the video that I was going to play, I think they should... Did they show that in this video package, Bad News Brown getting a gift?
No, I don't think they did.
Hey, that I have to have a clip to play for you about how this feud came about.
If there's a backstory to this, which I know that there is based off of last week, because we saw a clip, incidentally, also on the Brother Love show of the Big Boss Man getting paid off to destroy Damien. So that kind of plays into this next thing, because the Big Boss Man was the special guest referee of the next match between Bad News Brown and Jake the Snake Roberts. Now, I didn't think that any match featuring Jake the Snake Roberts could ever be a low point in my mind, because to me, Jake the Snake Roberts is one of the best of all time. Well, how wrong I was, folks, because this is a low point. As a matter of fact, if it wasn't for the post-match angle, this might have been the point where I would have turned off the show and messaged Jelly and been like, I can't do this shit, I'm sorry. Because this was just absolutely nauseating. Because again, as all of Bad News Brown matches seem to do, this one ended in bullshittery. Now, apparently he left the company shortly after this match.
Yes, and I have the reason here in front of me.
Well, good, because I don't know what it is, so that's perfect.
Do you want to do now, or you want to continue?
But let me just continue my commentary, because it'll only take about 30 seconds.
And then I'll play the clip as well.
Well, pretty much this one ended very quickly, because after numerous warnings from the Big Boss Man, Bad News Brown insisted on taking shortcuts, and he got caught hitting Jake in the gut with a chair. Now, somehow, Bad News Brown found his disqualification to be a surprise. I don't know if they were trying to portray Bad News Brown as a angry loose cannon all the time, But it got very annoying to me because every single match that I've seen of his ended the same way. So it became very predictable as to what he was going to do. And to tell you the truth, while I don't know the circumstances, which Elio will let me in on in about 10 seconds, you know, I wasn't exactly upset when I heard that this was Bad News Brown's last match. Because, holy fuck, he was so annoying. Go ahead, Elio, I'm sorry.
Alright, so Bad News Brown left the WWF after SummerSlam 1990, claiming Vince McMahon failed to live up to his promise to make him the company's first black champion, which reportedly affected him and his wife.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the reason I have him in front of me.
and by the way, folks, I'm sure that you know, Vince McMahon didn't fail to be an asshole to him. I'm just, you know, that doesn't surprise me in the least. But if I'm being honest, personally, based off what I saw, I wouldn't have put the championship of any kind on Bad News Brown. But
now, this is where this feud came about.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
After WrestleMania 6, Bad News and Roddy Piper were supposed to continue their feud.
Oh, but I'm betting that got axed after the...
No, that's not the reason. So they were supposed to continue. His feud with Piper. Brown was initially planning to continue his feud with Piper, but since neither man would agree to lose to each other, their program was scrapped, and instead Brown was assigned to work with Jake the Snake Roberts, where Bad News used a sewer rat to counter Jake's snake.
Yeah.
And the sewer rat was actually a possum.
That's hilarious.
So I'm gonna play the video of where I'm getting this first started from April 22nd of 1990. Okay. So give me a minute and we'll be right back. All right, so this is an interview from April 22nd, 1990 with Mean Gene interviewing Bad News Brown.
Right.
My guest, ladies and gentlemen, this week is a man who has established himself as a loner. He does it all alone. He doesn't have any friends. He doesn't want any friends. He is tough. He is durable. He is a seasoned veteran from Harlem, New York, Bad News Brown.
Something, Mean Gene, for the first time in your life, you told the truth. Because Bad News Brown don't need no manager stealing his money. Bad News Brown doesn't need a partner who's going to stab him in the back. And Bad News Brown fears nobody, and he hates beer belly sharecroppers, and that means these people here.
All right, Bad News, on a lighter note, I have it on good authority that you're celebrating your birthday this week.
Who told you about my birthday? What the heck's going on? You been following me around or what?
Bad News, I understand.
How do you know it's my birthday?
I said I have it on good authority. And with that in mind, Bad News, I'm here to present you a birthday present.
A birthday present?
Yeah.
I don't want no birthday present. What is that? I don't want no birthday present. I don't need no birthday present.
It's for you.
I don't want it. I don't want no birthday present. What birthday present?
It's not important that who gave it to me.
No,
wait a minute.
It's my birthday present, isn't it?
Well, you said you didn't want it.
Don't worry about what I said. If you want to do something, yeah, stand here and hold this thing while I open it.
What is that? What's wrong with it?
Wait a minute. You scared me.
Yeah, wait a minute.
What? Just a bad news.
Hey, look at this.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry,
it's only a rubber snake. That's all it is. Here, you can have it.
I believe it was the intro to Jake and Benny Brown's feud. Is Jake giving Benny's a birthday gift, and of course, yes. I mean a snake. And of course, Benny would retaliate by bringing a sewer rat with him.
Yes, and then after the match got thrown out by Big Boss Man, Big Boss Man would save Damian from receiving a leg drop from Bad News, and then later Jake recovered enough to toss Damian onto Bad News, and Bad News ran away like a scared little bitch. Now, oddly enough, I don't blame people for running away from snakes, especially when they're tossed on them in involuntary fashion. But I have never understood people being afraid of snakes unless they knew ahead of time that they were venomous. That's a whole different thing. But I've never been afraid of snakes. As a matter of fact, I actually had one around my neck voluntarily when I was in the second grade.
Was this Damien?
No, but I wish it was. This was back in a time where a professional bought in a snake for whatever reason, and he asked if anyone wanted to hold the snake, so I ended up doing it, and the snake coiled around my neck, and it was a quite pleasant experience. So I'm not afraid of snakes, but I certainly understand why some people are. Also, incidentally, I have a double-headed snake tattooed on my arm, so I have quite an affinity for the creatures, apparently.
All right.
So, there you go.
All right, next up, you have nothing else? So, next up we have, this was random, Jim Duggan and Nikolai Volkoff versus the Orient Express.
Make it stop. Okay, first of all, before the match, okay, Nikolai Volkoff and Jim Duggan are singing the Star Spangled Banner, okay? And I thought the worst rendition I'd heard was from Roseanne Barr at the World Series. No. The worst version was Nikolai Volkoff and Jim Duggan at SummerSlam 90. Let me tell you that right now. Let me tell you something. It was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life. No. But I certainly wouldn't volunteer to see it again. Because much like this match, it was physically painful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, admittedly, I don't know the story of how Nikolai Volkoff and Jim Duggan became the best of friends.
You know what? I'm actually going to look that up while you're going on this match.
Which leads to my next question for Elio, which he's researching right now. Kind of peeked me to it before I could ask, but that was my next question. I fall victim to this sometimes because at the time this pay-per-view took place, I was 2 years old, right? So sometimes I'm not going to understand certain things that happen, and I have to refer to my co-host for help.
All right, but, Ben, I have some information for you. Do you want to continue, or am I going to give you your answer?
Go ahead, give me the answer.
All right, so a short time after the Bolsheviks split, which was around 1990, Volkoff became a face for the first time in his career. So his gimmick now was a recent defector, and he became very pro-West, which led to a feud with Sergeant Slaughter, who was a heel at this time.
Yeah.
All right, so apparently Volkoff's embracing the U.S., which got the attention of Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and there was your pairing.
And it's interesting that you should mention Sergeant Slaughter turning heel, because that leads us to the next segment. See, and we didn't even plan this shit.
You puke, you maggot. Let's go with the Brother Love Show.
Well, you know, file this under things I never want to see again. Look, I'm not a fan of the Brother Love thing. However, I will acknowledge that if his job is to be an annoying heel, then he did his job masterfully because, you know, the brother love character is ridiculous and annoying at the same time. But I never thought that he would be more annoying than any other time I've ever seen him, because I thought he had hit his worst when he did his interview with Martin Downey Jr. Holy shit, was I wrong. Because enter a heel Sergeant Slaughter, where he was a sympathetic to the East.
Yeah, the Iraqi sympathizer.
Yes, exactly. And for those of you that don't know, tell me I don't do my research, but I actually knew this ahead of time. So this was the beginning of Slaughter turning heel and would lead him to winning the WWE title. And that would lead us to WrestleMania 7 with him against Hulk Hogan. And we will be covering WrestleMania 7 before too long, but I think we've covered WrestleMania 7 before on this show, not as in depth as we do on this show, so we'll happily do it again. But I think I do recall this match. So it was kind of interesting to get more background on it via this Brother Love segment. But I have to acknowledge, Elio, that I almost turned it off because Sergeant Slaughter and Brother Love having a mutual love fest all over each other, culminating in Sergeant Slaughter rewarding Brother Love with a outstanding citizenship medal or whatever it was.
For what?
Was quite sickening.
For what? I want to award you this medal.
It was bad. So, if you ever watch SummerSlam 90 and you need a bathroom break segment planned before you start this thing, Brother Love will happily provide you with one, courtesy of his segment with Sergeant Slaughter. Incidentally enough, if you want to take an extended bathroom break and look for a snack, you can happily skip Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Nikolai Volkoff, because not only is it a very boring match with the Orient Express lasting only 3 minutes and 22 seconds,
but you
also have to suffer through a duet featuring Nikolai Volkoff and Jim Duggan, which, if that sounds painful, believe me, it sounded just as painful as it sounds saying it. God damn, that was a tongue twister. I'm surprised I got that out. That was like me trying to pronounce a Japanese name as well as Elio does on this show. the match itself was absolutely awful. And then after this, we get clips of Sapphire knocking on doors, looking for Sapphire, and then right after this is when we switch to Dusty Rhodes searching for Sapphire again, and this is where he discovers that DiBiase has purchased Sapphire. Perhaps that angle wouldn't go very well today, because a rich white man purchased a black woman courtesy of a diamond necklace and a Cadillac. You run into certain segments that you know just wouldn't go very well in today's day and age. And, you know, Roddy Piper in blackface at WrestleMania 6 being one of them. And Ted DiBiase purchasing Sweet Sapphire is another one. This one, it was like, oh, my God. But it did leave us with Dusty Rhodes versus Randy Savage, which, you know, had I seen the card and not the match, I honestly would have thought that this would have been a high point, but much like their match at WrestleMania 6, it was actually a low point because, shockingly, it only got 2 minutes and 15 seconds, which is a capital crime to go along with the crime of making Sapphire a slave to Ted DiBiase for the price of a necklace and a Cadillac.
Yeah, right.
God damn. I understand it being a different time, and like I always say, and I think people will understand this about me from listening to the show, I am not Mr. Politically Correct or, you know, Mr. Sensitive all the time. As a matter of fact, not at all. But, you know, it shocks me for a company the size of WWE that they wouldn't have the sense ahead of time, hey, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Now, granted, they weren't publicly traded at the time, but even so, you know, it's like, holy shit, that's not a good storyline to run with. And this is certainly one of them. Elio, do we have to go for a break before we talk about the next match?
Which is Hulk Hogan and Earthquake?
Yes.
Yes, we should go for a break because I want to play this clip. There's another Brother Love episode, but you're going to love this clip. Okay, I remember this one vividly. When they aired it live on TV.
Yeah, and I understand why this wasn't the main event, because the steel cage between the Ultimate Warrior and Rick Rude was for the WWE Championship. So good on them for not violating my golden rule. But from an interest standpoint, I would have debated putting this as the main event because this came off as the bigger deal match, if I'm being honest with you. So stay right there before we get into the meat and potatoes of SummerSlam 1990. We'll be right back.
All right, Ben, I really wanted to get to this match. By the way, we are back, and we're going to get into the co-main event, because there were two main events. It was the way SummerSlam 90 was built.
Right.
And the one we are going to get into is the biggest feud of the summer at this time. And that was Earthquake versus Hulk Hogan. Ben, guess what?
What's that?
We have to attend a funeral.
Oh, what a bummer. I hate funerals.
Because live on the Brother Love Show, Hulkamania died.
Oh, what a pity.
Are you ready for this?
Yes.
They won't have to listen to me. And you and I can get a bird's eye view of the Brother Love Show. Come on, let's go down to Brother Love set. Thank you.
Jimmy Hart.
So that was the end of Hulkamania.
Well, apparently in that case, it was resurrected at SummerSlam 1990, I can assure you.
Now, I'll tell you this, they even played a montage following this. I think the week after, they played like a tribute video, and like they were playing like Real American, like the piano version. And again, I love when they do these music videos. So I put the speaker, my radio, right up to the TV speaker. I recorded the music.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, Lord. Elio Canella, the music nerd.
I am a music nerd. Now, I'll tell you another story off air. Now, at this time, following this attack, they actually set up a P.O. box for people to write to get well Hulk Hogan Hulk cards to Hogan.
Yeah, I remember him talking about that in the interview before this match.
Alright, so Hulk Hogan versus the Earthquake at SummerSlam 90. Ben, what do we have here?
It's like I
By
said,
the way, this is the last video I'm playing because there really is nothing else after this.
Right. So it's like I said before the break, this actually felt like the bigger match than the main event, even though I understand why Rude and Warrior was the main event, because it was for the WWF Championship, which has always been my rule. You know, if it's a title match, then it should be the main event. So from that perspective, I appreciated that. But because it was Hogan's big return after 4 months. Technically, he had wrestled 2 weeks beforehand in Japan against Stan Hansen, according to my research. But in terms of WWF, this was his first match in 4 months, to sell the damage that we you just heard from Earthquake, and I just saw courtesy of Elio. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
It ties things together quite nicely. So for that reason, and also how the match was presented, this actually felt like the bigger match. And there was also another reason why this one felt bigger, because originally Tugboat was supposed to be in the corner of Hogan for this.
Yes, that's right. I remember.
But which is interesting because he is Earthquake's former partner in the natural disasters, but he was taken out courtesy of the earthquake. He was Typhoon.
Keep going. I'm going to look something up real quick.
He was Typhoon in the natural disasters, but Earthquake took him out so that Big Boss Man had to replace him in Hogan's Corner for this match. So Boss Man actually pulled double duty, both refereeing for Jake Roberts and Bad News Brown and standing in the corner of Hulk Hogan for the championship match against Earthquake. So we saw a lot of development for Big Boss Man. And actually, in my opinion, after seeing this, it kind of cemented Big Boss Man's face turn. Because if you'll remember from last week, we played another edition of the Brother Love Show where Jimmy Hart and Earthquake had paid Boss Man to like either steal or kill Damien, and he actually gave Damien back to Jake the Snake Roberts, which played into the storyline that took place after the Jake Roberts match. And
Ben, you mean Ted DiBiase paid Boss Man?
Yes. Yes.
You said Earthquake.
Yes, I meant Ted DiBiase. Exactly right. Thank you for the correction. You're exactly right. So there was a lot of tie-ins to this, so it actually made everything make a lot more sense. The fact that we've been tying in clips to this show, so that's awesome. But it also helps you guys understand why we do what we do with these retro shows. So that's also awesome because, in addition to me, it helps you guys as well. So yay. Hats off to the professor. I would take my hat off and tip it to you, but then I'd have to take my headphones off and it becomes a thing. So virtual hat tip to you. The announcers did a very good job of making this feel like a huge match. Pace-wise, it started out really, really slow, which doesn't surprise me given the size of Earthquake and also how Hogan worked his matches. But personally, I would have preferred it to start a little bit faster and then slow down in the middle, whereas it was really slow in the beginning and the middle and then picked up at the end, which I get that pacing, but that's just not my favorite. But it was very 80s kind of booking. But, we are still in 1990 at this point, so I guess it's allowed. But it was a very good match from a storytelling perspective because Earthquake continuously went after the torso region and the chest region, which were summarily destroyed by three earthquakes at the that we just saw on the Brother Love Show. And I'll tell you what, if he was not to pull the curtain back too far, but if he was actually hitting him full force with those earthquakes, I think it would have shattered anybody.
Right?
For God's sake. So you see the value in
protecting. Quick story. One day we were in school, and this was in high school.
Right.
My friends and I, it was last period, it was gym class. We didn't really feel like going to class, so we faked that we were sick and we decided to skip. So however, we were in the gymnasium, we just weren't in gym class. We were up on the stage, we were having our own match. I was Hulk Hogan and he was the Earthquake, and he hit me with the Earthquake Splash.
Oh God. Well, did he did he do it properly or did he?
You know, he did it right. He did it right. But then like the teacher heard all this commotion behind the curtains because the curtains were closed. The stage were closed. She pulled it back and she scared. We got busted for skipping class.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And I'm laying there pretending to be injured from after receiving this earthquake splash.
That's insanity. That's awesome. I have a few stories like that from high school, so it sounded like you and I were causing the same kind of havoc back then. So that's hilarious. But yeah, that was the story of the match, and then of course Hogan did his hulking up comeback, and actually, one of my favorite parts was actually at the very end where Hogan went for the big kick and he didn't even knock Earthquake down. I don't think I've ever seen that spot before, so that was very cool. And then at the end of the match, Boss Man kind of solidified his face turn by smashing the crap out of Earthquake's back with the chair. And this was not your typical steel chair. It had like the slats in it, and you could kind of see it explode, each time that it hit Earthquake, and the welts on Earthquake's back. I mean, even the announcers were like, holy crap. Kind of thing. So, but the way that it was done, you have to hit Earthquake like that, otherwise he's not gonna feel it because he's guy fucking enormous. So was it a classic match? No. But it was a very good story with how, Earthquake came in and how it all evolved to give us this match, and I was especially entertained when Jimmy Hart tried to get involved and Hogan caught him, because we all know the history between Hogan and Jimmy Hart, so I was kind of laughing at that. So from that perspective, this match was actually a highlight for me. So if I was doing the typical high points, low points, there would be a lot of low points on this card, vastly outweighing the high points, but this would be a high point for me. Just from a storytelling perspective, this was done very well. And you could tell because the crowd was like super into it. And, it sounds cliche to say that when the crowd is into it, it can make a bad match decent and a decent match good and a good match great. But in this case, it really did. It made a decent match very, very good. And I think that's what's missing from wrestling nowadays. So it's really cool for me to go back and really see these shows for the first time, because the shows that I'm so familiar with are from like 97, 98, that kind of stuff, because that's when I was really old enough to start understanding what was going on.
And when we get to that year, there's a lot of stuff that I missed. I'm gonna need like help on some of this, because because there was all these tournaments going on that I didn't get to see.
Yeah, and I can certainly help you out with that, because I was I didn't get pay per views back then, but I was very locked into the storylines and Raw and SmackDown, so I pretty much knew everything that was going on back then. Even when my parents were like, you can't watch wrestling anymore, I was like, fuck that.
Little Ben Pierce.
Yeah.
Little nine-year-old Ben is not allowed to watch wrestling no more. Not allowed. That's it. You're banned. Ben.
Well, they tried to do that, you know, and it was just like, But it was so easy because, you know, they went to sleep at 9 o'clock. So, you know, what time does Raw start back then?
9 o'clock.
Exactly. So.
But now, again, your room is downstairs.
It wasn't at this point. In this house, it is. But, you know, at both of my other houses, it was upstairs. But it still wasn't that hard because, you know, not to use this against her, because in all seriousness, my mother is half deaf. But you know, that combined with the fact that, you know, they went to bed early, it wasn't that hard to sneak and watch wrestling when I wanted to.
My parents like, fuck yeah, go watch it, I don't care. Go ahead.
So,
my dad only had only one rule. I think I already told you, no wrestling if you want to go rent videos. Because you watch it every week on TV.
Yeah. And that wouldn't have even fly with me because I rented a lot of wrestling videos.
I found a loophole around it. I think I told you. My brothers would rent one, I'd rent one, and we get the third one free, which would usually be me picking a wrestling video.
Yeah. Well, actually, I didn't know that, but that's very smart on your part. Yeah, I used to love, I think I told you this. We used to have this video store called Video Times in my area, and I would haunt the wrestling section with that and Blockbuster too. So yeah, I was always a wrestling nerd. But yeah, so this was like classic WWF storytelling where like the match left something to be desired, but the storytelling was so good that like, if you understood everything that was going on there, you kind of overlook the wrestling aspect of it. So from that perspective, it was very reminiscent of like the Attitude Era. Where, you know, let's be honest with you, right? Everybody romanticizes the Attitude Era, but really the wrestling wasn't always that great.
Thank you. And that's what I mean when I say the Attitude Era sucked. It's not the Attitude Era itself. It's the matches. The wrestling was not good.
Yeah, exactly.
And then people get mad. And then you fans get mad when I say that the Attitude Era sucked.
Now, there are exceptions to that. I'm not saying that every match sucked.
No, not every. I like for the most part. Like the ones who we saw on TV, not all of them were good.
Yeah, exactly. So the last match of the night was Rick Rude versus the Ultimate Warrior. And quite frankly, if I'm being honest with you, I was dreading this match because I'm like, oh my God, you know, Rude is going to have to absolutely just hold Warrior's hand through this whole motherfucker because, you know, Rude was on an entirely different level than Ultimate Warrior from a wrestling perspective.
Before you go on, I'm gonna just say, I get what they're doing. They were building the Warrior up. I think Rick Rude should have gotten a run with the WWF Championship.
Well, I agree, and my biggest gripe and why I didn't like this match at all wasn't because the wrestling wasn't good or, you know, Rick Rude didn't do a good job. But the reason why this match was a low point for me, and hear me out here, folks, because I think if you watch it and understand the point that I'm about to make, you'll agree with me, right? So Rick Rude was made to look like a moron during this match. An absolute moron. Because there were three times, I shit you not, three times where he could have easily climbed the cage, won the match. He could have easily pinned him. There were three ways back in the day that you could have won cage matches. You could have won by pinfall. You could have won by, you know, going over the top, going through the door. You know, this was
pinfalls as well.
Yeah. And I hate that, but pinfalls did count.
I thought they came up with that stupid rule like later in the 90s or the 2000s.
No, well, apparently not, because pinfalls were attempted in this match as well.
Wow, so I
didn't like that. So from a lot of perspectives, this match was behind the eight ball. But my biggest gripe was that Rick Rude on several occasions was made to look like a, you know, Batman's asshole in terms of, you know, his intelligence quotient, because, you know, there were so many times where he could have easily won the match any way he wanted to, but he was so obsessed with, quote unquote, punishing the Warrior that he forgot to, you know, win the championship. And the announcers were pointing that out, yes, but Heenan, who was in Rude's corner, was like, "What are you doing? Go through the door, pin him, you know, go," like, each time, like, Rick Rude was like an idiot, you know, ignoring the coach's obvious decisions. Like if this was football, you know, he would have this gaping hole in the offensive line to run for a touchdown to win the Super Bowl, and he wouldn't do it. You know, and from that perspective, the match took a massive nosedive because the Ultimate Warrior was made to look more intelligent than Rick Rude when Ultimate Warrior couldn't cut a coherent promo. Now, granted, that was his character, but I'm willing to bet you that Jim Hellwig could not cut a coherent promo if you try.
I'm going to look up one of his promos as a Dingle Warrior to see, and if I find it, I'll play it on, like, maybe on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. So for that reason, I really didn't like this match. I understood its appeal. You know, they had a lot of cool spots, like Ultimate Warrior breaking the Rude Awakening by breaking Rude's grip. You know, they at the very beginning of the match, Rude went up, you know, the inside of the cage as Ultimate Warrior was making his entrance, and Ultimate Warrior came up the outside and knocked Rude, you know, 15 feet down to the floor.
Oh my god, okay, Ben actually found a Dingle Warrior promo.
Go ahead and play it, let's see.
Alright. Hopefully I don't get mad first.
There's a lot of changes happening in world class right now, but most importantly, the number one thing on the Dingo's mind right now is getting revenge with the Maniac, the Mad Dog, and Percy Pringle. Especially Percy Pringle. I almost got my revenge the other night with Percy Pringle. I had my hands around his neck. It was unbelievable. They were just sliding. I was going clear through his neck. But the Maniac came in and saved him just like they always do. They attacked me from behind.
And that's one of the frustrating things that the Dingo's ready to conquer. But Dingo, as we look at that, there are other things coming at you. Here's Larry Sharp with a guy like Crusher Yurkoff, a fiendish personality, 390 pounds, and wild, fast, acrobatic skill in the ring.
You know, I don't know where they get all these crazy people. You know, you got the Maniac, you got the Mad Dog, you got Abdullah the Butcher. Now you got this guy called Crusher that's got a big tattoo on his head. I don't know where they dig these guys up, but the Dingo isn't scared of anybody and doesn't fear anything. You bring him on, you can bring Larry Sharp on. The odds are never, even when they're against the Dingo, it doesn't matter because the Dingo always comes out on top.
Wrestling fans around the world, you've seen lots of talent, but you will never find a more exciting, motivated guy in the 80s than the Dingo Warrior, ready to face the battles that are already underway with great plans to win the war, right?
That's right. When the Dingo goes in to do battle, there may be a few battles,
But when the war comes about, the dingo will always come out on top. You can go to the bank on that.
All right, so that was from World Class Championship Wrestling.
That was actually that was actually the most coherent promo I've heard from the Ultimate Warrior. And it was
How did he go from that to this?
I mean, good Lord, the powers of the universe. No. And like I said, I understand the appeal of the Ultimate Warrior. I've told you this too. One of my friends from Elite literally has Ultimate Warrior quote tattooed on it. Which is, I'm not taking anything away from his ability to capture people's imaginations. That's the point of professional wrestling. That's why, there are so many podcasts, including ours, talking about what other people say is a fake sport involving people in their underwear. And that's why, people get upset when, you call professional wrestling fake. Because if you do that in front of me, you're insulting friends of mine who have literally been in the business for 25 years. And I have a problem with that because professional wrestling has given us so much, and it's because of characters like the Ultimate Warrior or, Hulk Hogan or, Randy Savage that we have, the opportunity and the platforms to talk wrestling and call it a job.
And we don't come to your workplace and call what you do fake, so.
But ask Elio or ask me, is it easy to come on here and talk wrestling, 300 episodes strong with a following like we have? Is it easy, Elio?
No, there's a lot of research.
Do we just throw on headphones and talk shit without knowing what we're talking about?
Nope.
When we were both working for POV, was there a lot of communication back and forth? Like, what are we going to do? How do you want to approach this part? How do you want to talk about this week? And, there's a lot of, we're in front of millions of people, a week, on POV. And on here, we have a very solid following of our own. Not in the millions, mind you, but that's because, we don't actually, interview wrestlers and whatever, and we're not former wrestlers like Tony Diaz is, all due respect to him. What we do certainly isn't fake. We're not sitting in our underwear just, doing whatever and, calling it a job. We actually shave, we shower, and, I don't want to hear that about, internet wrestling fans, because we're not those people.
All right. So, Ben, we're going to have to wrap it up. So, wow, this show.
Yes. So, pardon my rant, but I get upset when the word fake is used for very particular reasons. So, to wrap it up. SummerSlam 1990 wasn't the most impressive show, but the co-main event and main event did their job in terms of making the show interesting. Next week, we'll be back with Survivor Series 1990. So the time
we're going to find out Ted DiBiase's mystery partner for the million-dollar team, and I'm going to have another story for you.
Absolutely. You do not want to miss Survivor Series 1990. I'm Ben, he's Elio. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Tuesday Timeline. We'll see you then.
Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.